From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, after more than 50 years, Congress fails to renew funding for community health centers, and the clock is ticking.
More than 100,000 patients stand to lose their ability to be seen in our centers in a timely way or at all. You know, we're looking at a 70% cut in federal funding if this isn't resolved.
Why so many Michigan teachers are frustrated with their jobs.
Good teachers are supermen and superwomen, and they really are underappreciated because most people don't really understand how difficult the job is and what makes it difficult.
The Christmas Eve tragedy 104 years ago in Copper Country.
Somebody yelled fire, sending the panicked children and families to the exit, which was the only exit, down a narrow stairway.
Those stories and more on Stateside. Hello and welcome to Stateside for a very snowy Wednesday. I'm Cynthia Canty. Coming up later in the hour, we talk with a Michigan school administrator about low teacher morale throughout the state and the reasons behind it. And we'll hear an idea for bringing more Black girls and women into the fold of architecture and urban planning. But first, since 1965, community health centers have provided care for low-income and uninsured Americans. Well, now that vital care for 26 million people in more than 10,000 locations is threatened by the failure of Congress to renew its funding. Loretta Bush is CEO of the Michigan Primary Care Association. Loretta, how many community health centers are in Michigan, and how many people rely on them for medical and dental care?
Yeah, so here in Michigan, we have 40 health centers throughout the state. But those health centers represent about 260 sites across the state because they have multiple sites. Every year we see just under 7,000 patients a year. But with those 7,000 patients, that's just over 2 million visits every year. So we're talking about a very large patient population covering rural, urban, and suburban. And in all of those areas, really touching the lives of the most vulnerable residents of our state.
So we're talking about uninsured or low-income people of all ages.
Of all ages. And while health centers are able to take all insurances and people of all incomes, we predominantly see those who are uninsured, underinsured, especially uninsured before the Healthy Michigan Plan. Of course, with the passage of the ACA, which allowed for the Healthy Michigan Plan to come in place, more and more of the people we see now have the Healthy Michigan Plan, which is a great benefit for them and increases access. But even before that, our mission is to see everyone that walks through the door. That's what the health center movement was about 50 years ago, and that remains the same today.
And Loretta, what are the range, give me an idea of the kinds of services, the health services that people can get when they walk into a community health center?
Our bread and butter, our base is primary care and preventative care. So this is one of the few areas that has truly made an investment in preventative care, in primary care, in identifying chronic disease, teaching people how to manage their chronic disease. So that's kind of the base at which we start. We also provide maternal and child care, dental care in most of our facilities, and the connection between good oral health or poor oral health and physical health in general is well known. And so that's a critical part of what we do. And then also the integration of behavioral health services. So it's really a mind, body, and oral health.
So here we have federal funding that has kept these doors open for all of these years. What has happened to this federal funding?
What a great question. This is such uncertain times. We in the past have always enjoyed bipartisan support, and we feel that we still have that bipartisan support. But unfortunately, with all of the other wrangling that's going on in Congress about trying to repeal the ACA and now this new tax reform, the health center funding has kind of got caught up in a lot of other things, something that we have not seen over the years. And it feels very unsettling. It is very unsettling for us in our attempts to go forward. So to this date, there has not been a refunding of the health centers. And we're getting very close to that point when health centers in Michigan and all over the country are going to have to start making some very difficult decisions if Congress doesn't make a decision soon to refund the funding that supports health centers.
And that's the Community Health Centers Fund, $3.6 billion that expired September 30th. So if they don't get it together in Washington, and if this Community Health Centers Fund is not renewed, what will happen to these centers as each month comes and people's funding comes up?
Well, what's going to start to happen, and even right now, Michigan health centers have started planning and considering the worst. So they're looking at contingency plans like reducing medical services, behavioral health services, dental services, the services that I just described to you that said really those services really go to the body, the mind, and then the oral health, the total health of the patient. So all of those are could potentially be reduced. Of course, it's going to have a job and economic effect as people start to look at hiring freezes or reducing staff. And also, some of the most expensive services, but they are very much needed, are services that combat the opioid epidemic. And I know that in Washington, there's the rhetoric that there's the fight and the work around opioid, the opioid epidemic. But if this funding isn't restored, one of the major players in this fight, which are health centers, will definitely have to look at cutting those services back, such as medication-assisted treatment and having health coaches to work with people as they are working to free themselves of their addiction.
I did see one statistic, a policy brief from the National Association of Community Health Centers saying somewhere, if the funds aren't renewed, somewhere between 76,000 to 161,000 private jobs could be lost. So this is a really wide-ranging impact, isn't it?
This is a wide-ranging impact that certainly Michigan cannot withstand. Our Michigan health centers, we employ about 5,500 staff in our centers across the state. So those jobs are at jeopardy. More than 100,000 patients stand to lose their ability to be seen in our centers in a timely way or at all. You know, we're looking at a 70% cut in federal funding if this isn't resolved.
So what needs to happen? Where do things stand now and what has to happen?
So we're looking at last week, Congress passed this two-week spending bill to keep the government open. But unfortunately, it did not include health center funding. So it looks like we are moving to this end of the year battle when health centers will be lumped in with a whole lot of other things. So what we are needing is for people who understand the importance of access to health care for all to call Congress and ask to speak to their senator or their representative and say, we need them to reauthorize the health center funding immediately.
Loretta, you have seen these centers at work. You know what they mean in the lives of the clients who come in. If you could stand on the floor and talk to Congress right now about these centers and what they mean for people, what would you say?
I would say that I have seen these centers absolutely save people's lives. People come in hopeless and in despair, let's say for drug use. Many of our health centers provide Vivitrol. And this is the story that I hear time and time again when I interact with those patients who have gone through the program. They say, I got my life back. I got my kids back. I got my job back. I got my dignity back. And isn't that what we want for all of our all Michiganders and all people all over the country who are struggling in this opioid epidemic? That would be impacted. The staff is always friendly and receptive, many times from the same communities that the patients come from. The board is 51% users of the services. That's a requirement of health centers. So everything comes together to really wrap their arms around the patient and to help to restore them to optimum health. And this is what people will see in each and every health center.
It must be very hard to see this caught in a political fight, in congressional inaction.
Oh, it is very, very difficult to see it caught up in the muck and mire. It really is. And it needs to be resolved, and it needs to be resolved quickly. We need to go back to civil discussion around how to solve this particular issue and not let it get caught up in partisan rhetoric, which is, unfortunately it is now. And as we get to the end of the year, when everything gets rolled up and everybody is trading back and forth for what they want, the fear is that health centers may get lost in this shuffle. We already have, and now we're getting down to the wire where health centers around the country may be facing a 70% cut and closing their doors, and most importantly, leaving millions of people without access to high-quality, cost-effective care. And I'll throw in the cost-effectiveness, because really, the health centers have proven over the years, and this is why we've received bipartisan support, we have proven over the last 50 years that we can bring high-quality, comprehensive services to a very vulnerable and fragile population at a great cost. And no one can deny that. But yet, here we are on the cusp of possibly losing 70% of our funding. It just doesn't make sense. And Congress needs to hear from people saying, this doesn't make sense. We want you to stop delay. We no longer want you to delay the funding of the health centers.
Loretta Bush, CEO of the Michigan Primary Care Association. Loretta, thank you for speaking with us.
Thank you for giving me the time.
Still to come, inside the Christmas Eve tragedy 104 years ago in Copper Country.
Somebody yelled fire, sending the panicked children and families to the exit, which was the only exit, down a narrow stairway.
And when you add, you know, into the mix of all these little kids and trying to get down a stairway, it just became catastrophic.
That story in 10 minutes right here on Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. The Me Too movement has launched us into a national discussion about sexual harassment, particularly committed by men in the workplace. My next guest believes we should also be talking about another aspect of sexual assault, forced sex in intimate relationships. One study estimates more than 12 million adults in this country, most of them women, experience intimate partner violence every year. Dr. Shervin Asari is an assistant professor of psychiatry and public health at the University of Michigan. Doctor, that number I just cited indicates this is an all-too-common problem in this country, something you call long-overlooked but insidious?
Yes, thank you very much for having me. Yes, it is a very common, not only in the United States, in almost any country in the world. So we know that women more frequently get exposed to violence, both in the workplace and also in intimate partner relations. And also, this is very common for young people and minority people and people who are either unemployed or have lower power in their relation or in their workforce.
Because it's about power, isn't it?
It is about power, exactly. So one reason men commit this more is because they have the more chances for employment and also age difference. Overall, usually men are older in the intimate relations, and that age difference has implication for power issues.
Why so?
There is notation that power corrupts. So if you give power to people, not absolute power, just power, that corrupts. Zimbardo, Philip Zimbardo at Stanford, conducted a study years ago, a very landmark study, which showed innocent people, students, undergraduate students, who have high level of morality, if you give a group power, that they would start abusing that power against the other group which does not have power.
So they're not inherently evil, immoral people.
Exactly. It is powerful people who do that, or people who have an unbalanced power, not just people who are immoral.
So how does that play out in, let's say, a marriage?
In marriage, if the age difference is too high, or a female is a minority individual, or unemployed, or financially dependent to the male partner, or an immigrant. So any aspect, social aspect, which changes the strength or the relative power of the partners, that becomes a risk factor.
What are some other risk factors?
One big risk factor is substance use. So substance use, drugs, especially problem alcohol use. So not just entertaining with substance, but substance problem. That would increase the risk. And also depression. So it's not just intimate partner violence exposure make people depressed. Depression is also a risk factor for committing or perpetrating the violence. So it is both ways. And also another part is impulse issues or anger management or emotion regulation issues. So it's very interesting. We go to school, and by going to school, we learn how to regulate our emotion. That is why, on average, a higher socioeconomic place would be lower in these problems. That is not because they have moral standards more than the other group. It's just because they have received higher quality of education and they have learned to regulate their emotions. And that means prevention of these type of behaviors.
When we talk about intimate partner violence, what kind of acts, what kind of behaviors are we talking about?
Intimate partner violence includes verbal, psychological, physical, and sexual abuse. In sexual abuse, that also from rape to forced sex. Like one partner may not want sex in a particular time or a particular way of having sex. So all these are being categorized as intimate partner violence.
And what about the consequences to the victim in terms of her physical health and her mental health?
It's very difficult to assume that being exposed to intimate partner violence increases risk of asthma, but it does. It increases risk of heart disease. It increases risk of bowel syndromes like IBS. Mm-hmm. There is almost no medical or psychiatric problem that exposure to intimate partner violence doesn't increase that risk.
Is that because the body is just always in that kind of fight or flight?
Because it is a stress.
Yes,
right.
Constant stress.
Absolutely.
How do you think, Doctor, that we as a society should confront and talk about this problem of forced sex in intimate relationships? I mean, what are we not doing that we should be doing?
One aspect of it is we can always do more of prevention. And again, prevention has different levels. One is giving treatment to people who are either depressed, to people who have emotion regulation problems or substance use problems. But a more broad intervention is to reduce poverty, to have laws and regulations who support minorities, immigrants, increasing quality of education at the school. So many public policies would promote these type of behaviors through reducing mental health problems and also emotional regulation.
And these things you describe are not exactly happening in America in 2017.
I think U.S. is doing worse than before when it comes to immigration, when it comes to welfare, and also quality of education in urban areas and many other things.
What if you suspect that a friend or a relative is being sexually abused by a spouse or a partner? Maybe they're not saying it, but you get the feeling something is up. What are the best ways to bring it up and help her seek help?
Okay, one issue is that these people are suffering in silence. So the people around them need to approach them and have the conversation and say, it's not your fault, making distance from victim blaming, because victims may blame themselves. So maybe something is wrong with myself.
So might I say to a friend, is everything okay? I mean, what, give me some ideas of things to break the ice and actually start the conversation.
Conversation would be difficult because this is still taboo. So it is not easy to talk about social problems at this level, especially if it is like physical aggression. But overall, approaching each other, increasing social support, having conversation about all of these, especially in close relationships, like a close friend or parents, like parent asking their children. So if you saw a dysfunctional relation, that may signal the presence of something in the relation. Mm-hmm. The other one is that, again, mental health problems are cause and consequences. So if you see someone getting depressed and more than before, that might be related to some of these exposures. So be aware of those signals and then approaching people and trying to offer them some help.
Dr. Shervin Asari is an assistant professor of psychiatry and public health at the University of Michigan. You'll find his essay on forced sex and intimate relationships by going to theconversation.com. Doctor, thank you so very much.
Of course, my pleasure.
It's Wednesday, which means it's time to talk Michigan history.
You have to think about your dream and what you want to do.
If our cities go down, in my opinion, our nation will go down.
All we were trying to do was just get music for all people.
104 years ago this month, some 400 miners and their families were at a Christmas Eve celebration in Calumet in the Upper Peninsula. 73 men, women, and children would not live to see Christmas Day. We know this tragedy is the Italian Hall disaster, also known as the 1913 massacre, born out of the depths of a long and bitter miners' strike. Historian Troy Henderson of the Michigan History Center is here with us, as is Steve Leto, who's an attorney and author of Death's Door, The Truth Behind Michigan's Largest Mass Murder. It's a pleasure to have both of you with us today.
Thank you.
It's good to be here.
Troy, Calumet is in the Keweenaw Peninsula, copper country. 1913 was a bitter, bitter year in the mines. Tell us about this strike.
Yeah, the Keweenaw Peninsula is well known for copper mining specifically, and the industry was booming in the early 1900s. The copper companies were big. They employed thousands of miners. They had a lot of capital and a lot of community control. Like on the nearby iron ranges, among the ranks of miners were thousands of immigrants from varying backgrounds. In 1913 specifically, a strike took place on the Keweenaw Peninsula, and that was organized by the Western Federation of Miners. And they were spurred a little bit by some success in organizing miners out west, and the union sought to gain a foothold in Michigan's copper mines. And they slowly gained some influence. And in 1913, pro-union numbers swelled with, among other things, the company's introduction to implement the single-man drill in the mines. And there was an array of other issues, too. July of 1913 marked the beginning of a lengthy strike in the Keweenaw. The Western Federation of Miners went on strike. And for a time, the mines, principally the Calumet and Hecla mine, actually shut down. Stopped producing. Over the summer and into the fall, the strike disrupted a community. It was an emotionally charged time. It was divisive. It was violent. The communities were being torn apart, and people were forced to choose sides in this conflict.
Steve, the managers and the owners of the Calumet and Hecla mine really mobilized, didn't they?
Back then, it was considered good business to not negotiate. So the mine management absolutely steadfastly refused to even talk to the union. They wouldn't recognize that the union existed. And in fact, they openly fought the union by bringing in strike breakers. They actually brought in people who were specialists in disrupting strikes. These are people who would come in, you know, get their hands dirty, actually going down and disrupting strike activities. If the strikers were marching someplace, these guys might show up and get in fist fights with them. And there was a lot of violence. And people looking back on this in later years pointed out that much of the violence wasn't caused by the strikers. It was caused by the strike breakers who were brought in by mine management.
So Troy Henderson, it's Christmas time. It has been a rough few months since the strike started in the summer, and miners and their families go to the Italian Hall for a Christmas party sponsored by the Ladies Auxiliary of the Western Federation of Miners. Tell us what happened.
Yeah, the Western Federation of Miners planned this party, and it was primarily for children of striking miners. You know, and these families had limited income at that time since they were not getting their usual wages because they were taking part in the strike. So hundreds of children celebrated Christmas on the second floor of the Italian Hall in Calumet. And as the party was winding down a little bit later in the afternoon, somebody yelled fire, sending the panicked children and families to the exit, which was the only exit, down a narrow stairway. At some point toward the bottom, somebody tripped, and it began to create a backlog of people wanting to get out. The more people that piled on, the more force it put on the people on the bottom. And 73 people, the majority of them children, were crushed to death in that stairway. And there was actually no fire.
There was actually no fire. And I think a modern day thing that people may remember is on a smaller scale, but terrible. The idea of a crushing force of a crowd was that Who concert in Cincinnati when everybody tried to crush in to get inside a door. And they had, I think, 13. Not as bad, but that idea of the force of a crowd, that is really terrifying, isn't it, Steve?
Remember, you know, what we're talking about here is people getting crushed in a stampede, and they're going down an extremely steep flight of stairs, and there were people pushing from behind, but also the crowd is largely children. And as you pointed out at the Who concert, that was on level ground. That was, you know, people pushing forward. And when you add, you know, into the mix of all these little kids and trying to get down a stairway, it just became catastrophic. And, you know, the pileup in the stairway actually took quite some time to clear, and they couldn't even clear it from underneath. They had to have rescuers come in. There was a fire escape on the side of the building, and they went up the fire escape and came around inside and had to undo this, you know, tangle of bodies from the top. And, you know, as they pulled people out of the stairway, they realized that there was, you know, dozens and dozens of people dead. Vast majority of them were, in fact, children.
And this, Steve, became a source for conspiracy theories. What are some of the more popular theories about what happened then?
Well, a lot of witnesses said they saw the guy come in from outside and yell fire and then, you know, take off. So it wasn't a person inside the hall. There was no fire. So it sounds like somebody came in specifically to break the party up. And the most obvious culprits were strikebreakers, because strikebreakers had been disrupting union activities all year long. And so a strikebreaker would have thought, hey, I can go and break up this party and I won't get in trouble for it. I believe it was a strikebreaker who ran into the party and yelled fire to break the party up. And in my research, I came across the story of a guy named Edward Manley, who was a strikebreaker, who was mysteriously pulled out of the pile of the people on the stairs. And what was a strikebreaker doing in that pile? And I explain in much more detail in my book, but that guy had no reason to be there. And he was very quickly spirited away from the catastrophe as they cleaned it up. And he disappears from the story. And I honestly think that mine management, when they heard that this guy had done this, said, you know something, get this guy out of town. We'll never speak of him again. And the guy disappears from the story. But I'm convinced that he was the man who cried fire. Now, I don't think he intended to kill people, but he did make a reckless act that resulted in the deaths of others. And as an attorney, I can tell you that's against the law. So I think that most people who study this, that, yeah, it was a guy who tried to break the party up and it killed people. But unfortunately, there's still people in the community to this day who will argue with you about it and say, no, it was simply a tragic accident. And I think some people can't wrap their head around the idea that someone would intentionally cause a disruption, killing children on Christmas Eve at a Christmas party. That is one of the most striking things about the story, is when it happened and who the victims are.
And Troy Henderson, you are a Youper. How is this disaster remembered in the Upper Peninsula?
Well, this disaster is well known in the UP, and it's preserved through stories, you know, people telling stories who were impacted by this event. For this tragedy, I like to draw kind of a comparison to an iron mine cave-in at Barnes Hecker, which killed 51 miners and actually entombed most of them underground, and they're still in that mine. This happened in 1926, and it's similar in the sense that there's kind of an unsettled feeling, a lack of closure to the event and to the tragedy. So today, you know, if you go to Calumet, the building is now gone. It eventually fell into disrepair and was demolished in 1984. But the stone arch of Lake Superior Sandstone that framed that stairway was preserved and is now on the spot where that building was, and a monument marks the tragedy today.
It's a sobering and very, very sad, sad moment in Michigan history, and you've taken us there very brilliantly, historian Troy Henderson with the Michigan History Center, and Steve Leto, attorney and author of Death's Door, The Truth Behind Michigan's Largest Mass Murder. I want to thank both of you for being with us for this edition of Michigan History and taking us to Calumet, Christmas Eve, 1913.
Thanks, Cynthia.
Happy to be here.
Support for arts and culture coverage comes in part from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs.
Take a trip with me in 1913. To Calumet, Michigan, in the copper country. I'll take you to a place called Italian Hall, and the miners are having their big Christmas ball. I'll take you in a door and up a high stairs. Singing and dancing is heard everywhere. I'll let you shake hands with the people you see and watch the kids dance around the big Christmas tree. There's talking and laughing and songs in the air, and the spirit of Christmas is there everywhere. Before you know it, you're friends with us all, and you're dancing around and around in the hall.
We'll be right back after a short break. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. There is so much renovation, new development happening in Detroit, but how many of the people designing these spaces are the ones who will actually work and live in them? That's the question that drives Tiffany Brown. She is an architectural designer who won a 2017 Knight Arts Challenge grant. She had an idea for bringing more Black girls and women into the field of architecture and urban planning. Her winning project is called 400 Forward. Tiffany Brown, welcome to Stateside. What is the significance of that name, 400 Forward?
So the significance of 400 Forward stemmed from the 400th living African-American woman becoming licensed this past August. So, and that's not 400 of, you know, the last 10 years or 50 years, that's 400 of all time out of 110,000 licensed architects in the country. So when that happened this past August, you know, I was just on a long run with the Urban Arts Collective, which we refer to as UAC, just kind of going around the country and teaching kids about architecture. And it just, you know, pushed me to seek out the next 400 group of women. You know, mostly African-American women, I guess I could say, because it's a number that represents 0.3%, like not even a half a percent of what the profession is. And, you know, that's just not what our communities look like.
So it's time to change that conversation.
Yes.
So as an architectural designer, I know you're close to becoming a fully licensed architect once you pass some licensing exams. You're a rarity. You are an African-American woman, grew up in Detroit. How'd you get into architecture?
I was actually exposed to architecture indirectly throughout my life. Like, no one came to my school to talk about architecture. So I grew up on the west side of Detroit, you know, in one of the more rough neighborhoods. And we just didn't have a lot of professionals coming there, period. So I was always drawing and drawing people in my class and just really into art. I had a wood shop class. So all of these things indirectly led me to architecture, because by the time I was in the 12th grade, someone from Lawrence Tech came to an assembly that we were having. Just, you know, she wasn't even an architect herself. She was just a recruiter. And by that time, I had become more interested in buildings and spaces. And so by that fall, at 17, I was starting, you know, undergrad at Lawrence Tech for Architecture. And 3 degrees later from there, I teach now.
There you are. And that isn't that fascinating that one person at the right time, mm-hmm. in the right place, opened up that door in your mm-hmm. mind to going down this path.
I have this little model that I try to be the face that I was looking for growing up. So if I go into a room or an auditorium and just one person is interested in architecture, then I've accomplished my mission.
So when you think of the reality that you just pointed out, that only 0.3% of licensed architects are Black women, what is being lost because of this lack of diversity?
Well, it's a profession that is integrated into our daily lives, the built environment, the spaces that we use every day. There's just a lot of construction and resurgence of Detroit in particular, that they're being led by companies that don't have the necessary diversity in their company to, I would say, design for the people that they're designing for. So
that point about how about if the people designing the spaces are the people who are going to use them?
Yes. So that's exactly what I want to do with 400 Forward, is just to teach girls, let them know that they have the ability to design these spaces, and they kind of have the responsibility to be the ones that create the cities that they're living in, or, you know, other people will come in and do it for them.
How do you want to close the gap through 400 Forward? Just what is it, and how is it structured?
By closing the gap, one of the main things is exposure. So just going into the schools and neighborhoods where I grew up, you know, in other neighborhoods in the city of Detroit, Detroit Public Schools in general, just to talk about what architecture means and talk about what urban planning means. And, you know, because they just don't know that they have the talent, you know, just try to pull it out of them and lead and guide and support them. And one way to support them is financially. So to study architecture is very expensive. To become licensed, the exams are very expensive. So this grant will help me assist professional women who are trying to become licensed in the field. And it will also help me assist grades K through 12, like students in that realm, to, you know, take them on trips and expose them to what architecture means.
And are you doing all this yourself, or do you have a core of people helping you?
You know, it's funny that you asked that, because the more exposure that, you know, my winning this grant is getting, I'm getting a lot of people reaching out to get involved. So that's a great feeling to know that, you know, there's just this whole audience of support that I didn't necessarily have to seek out. They're seeking me out. So I also have my colleagues and my fellow co-founders with Urban Arts Collective, who are Mike Ford and Eric Christian. And, you know, those two guys are great with initiatives that they've got going on. So, yeah, I do have a support system. It is a matching grant. So we are seeking out matching sponsors. And I know that there's a lot of money out there for STEM education. And, you know, I think that this would be a great cause.
Now, you are working real hard, Tiffany, to get girls looking at that pathway, women of color, to think of architecture and urban planning and design. If they pursue this rigorous path of study, will there be jobs for them?
Absolutely. There are jobs right now that, you know, just we don't have the people, we don't have the talent right now. I think if something like this had come up when I was a kid, we wouldn't have the drought right now with even construction workers, you know, people to build a diverse pool of people to do construction, to do architecture. Things are continuing to evolve. Technology is continuing to evolve. And so, you know, our STEM-related fields are just in need of diversity. So absolutely, there'll
be jobs.
There definitely will be jobs. There are jobs right now for them.
Here you are working through 400 Forward to make architecture more accessible for women of color. And so what do you hope your field looks like in 10 years?
So the communities right now that we have, they're diverse, you know, and it's kind of, architecture is just a stagnant profession going after projects in diverse communities. So what I would like to see 400 Forward do is to change that. And just, if you have a diverse team of architects or a diverse team of engineers or diverse team of scientists, it just makes for a better product.
How might the city of Detroit look different if more women of color were part of the design and the planning?
I think that Detroit would be much more inviting to the people who live there, to the people who are looking to live here, if it had the input from the people of the community involved in the decisions. I think that's what's missing from what's happening in Detroit right now.
Tiffany Brown is co-founder of the Urban Arts Collective and creator of 400 Forward, which won a matching 2017 Night Arts Challenge grant of $50,000, a matching grant, with her idea of bringing more women of color into the field of architecture and urban planning. Thank you so much for sharing your work with us.
Thank you so much for having me, Cynthia.
A survey of more than 11,000 Michigan teachers taken last year revealed a lot of them are unhappy. Michigan's two biggest teacher unions conducted the survey. Stateside recently talked to a couple of teachers in California who used to live and work in Michigan. And we asked them to reflect on some of the challenges they felt when they were educators in this state. And we're asking Jeff Bold to respond to some of these comments and give us some more insight as to just why so many teachers are so frustrated. Jeff Bold is the principal of Lakeview High School in Battle Creek, and it's a pleasure to welcome you back to Stateside, Jeff.
Thank you. It's always a pleasure, Cindy.
So, Jeff, the two former Michigan teachers that we talked with are a married couple, Julia and Rod Satterthwaite. Julia now teaches English and journalism at Monta Vista High School in California. She taught for 11 years at Rochester High School in Rochester Hills, Michigan. And then Rod teaches sports literature and journalism at Palo Alto High School in California. And he taught for 28 years in Michigan, most recently at Grosse Pointe South High School. Now, first off, we get a sense. Rod says he feels that people don't really understand or value what teachers do.
You know, when you would talk to people who don't understand teachers or didn't have kids in school, they would say, gosh, yeah, education in this state just sucks. Like, how come you guys can't do this better? Man, you get your summers off. How lucky you are. So there'd be all these negative comments about the job.
So how does apathy towards teachers influence the quality of education that our kids are getting?
That lack of understanding, I would say, has always had for teachers a tremendous negative impact. Teaching is just such an important profession, you know? I mean, teachers truly impact the future of our society and our world every day. Good teachers are supermen and superwomen, and they really are underappreciated because most people don't really understand how difficult the job is and what makes it difficult. Good teachers have to fully engage their heads and their hearts in what they do. They have to connect what's going on in their heads with what's going on in the heads of their students, and they have to connect emotionally, heart to heart, with the students that they have. And that can be, you know, super taxing. Really, it's interesting in education because everyone's been in a school. They feel like they know what teaching is like. But preparing for teaching and managing a classroom, it can really be very, very difficult. Imagine having to keep 25 to 30 kids intellectually engaged hour after hour when you know they're all bringing different levels of skills and knowledge and interests, and you're trying to make sure that you reach them all. And that can be really exhilarating and satisfying work, but it's tiring. And that intellectual part of teaching is really almost the easy part, because connecting with students, connecting with that many students, creating the strong emotional bonds that we know accelerate student learning, that is taxing as well. And our teachers work very hard to make sure that they've got the types of supportive, positive connections with all of their students so that students can learn as well as possible. And that in itself is exhausting. And it's really something that people who have never tried to orchestrate the activities in a classroom can truly understand.
Julia and Rod both mentioned that in Michigan, preparing for teacher evaluations took a lot of time, and Rod says he doesn't think any of it helped him improve.
It seemed very wasteful for me. Not one iota of it ever helped me become a better teacher, and I think that was maybe one of the most frustrating parts.
Have teacher evaluations led to any improvements in the quality of education kids are getting in Michigan, in your view?
Yes. Historically, evaluation has not always been done in ways that are helpful to improving teachers' growth in ways that are formative. The systems have become much more rigorous. Honestly, the systems that we had for evaluating teachers when I started as an administrator 14, 16 years ago were kind of a joke. And I can tell you that when I was using those evaluation systems, I had many teachers tell me, you know, this is the first time I've had a conversation in my 25 years of teaching around an evaluation that was helpful to my learning. So I do know that many teachers have not felt historically that evaluation processes are helpful to them. The more stringent, more rigorous evaluation processes that the state has approved for use now can create some stress. I mean, it is stressful to have your practice scrutinized that closely, but I can tell you that, you know, we're working on how to make that stress as little as possible and also make the experience as productive as possible. And I'm a firm believer that the process that we use here in Lakeview, which is the Charlotte Danielson method, one of the state-approved methods, has helped us improve the overall quality of what we're able to do for students in the classroom. So is it stressful? Yes. Can it be done poorly? Absolutely. Anything can be done poorly and can be ineffective. I don't believe, though, that that's the case across the board.
If you've just joined us, we're talking about the frustrations that Michigan teachers are having at work as we talk with Jeff Bull, who's principal of Lakeview High School in Battle Creek. And we're going over some comments from two former Michigan teachers, a married couple, Julia and Rod Satterthwaite, who are both now out of Michigan and teaching at high schools in California. Let's move over to the issue of pay. Julia said partway through her teaching career in Michigan, she stopped seeing wages grow even as class sizes in her district got bigger.
Basically, we were seeing a decrease in take-home pay over time and an increase in students in the classroom.
Yeah, so why are some districts in this position where they're paying teachers less and increasing the workload by putting more students in the classrooms?
You know, that varies district to district. I can tell you that that is a tremendous problem. There are many districts in Michigan, because of the downturn in the economy, because of the shifts in our economy, that have not been able to give steps to their teachers. Many people might not know that teachers' contracts usually include an increase by year up until, you know, a certain number of years of experience. And teachers in some districts have not gotten any raises, you know, in 4, 5, 6 years, no change in their pay at all. And then you add on top of that increased health insurance and retirement costs, and take home has decreased over that time for some teachers. And that is problematic. I mean, what it boils down to is that our society, our state, the people of our state need to just decide that we're going to value the education that we provide our students enough to make sure that we have the money to appropriately pay teachers for the very, very difficult and very valuable work that they're doing for our students.
And now Julia says she's told younger people thinking about becoming teachers, maybe you want to think about this again.
There are a certain number of teachers who are just so frustrated that when they hear that there are other people who are thinking about going into education, we give it a second thought. We're like, are you sure?
Jeff, what does that comment tell you about what it's going to be like recruiting teachers in Michigan in the future?
I can tell you that, you know, professionally, it worries me. Emotionally, that makes me very sad. I know teachers that have done that, that have talked to me about that, you know, talking about their own children. And when you're talking to your child about career choices, what we need, what our society needs, is for people to consider and think about the profession of teaching as one of the most honorable professions that you can get involved in. And we need them to understand that if you make that honorable choice, that you will be compensated for that and have a work life that is workable, you know, for the long run. Those are questions that people are asking right now, and it's causing a lot of stress on the system. There is no question.
So despite the pressures, it's interesting when you think that both Julia and Rod, you know, had quite a few pointers about stresses teaching in Michigan, and they have relocated, and they're still teaching. They didn't leave the profession. What does that tell you?
You know, teaching is one of the most exhilarating and satisfying lines of work that you can undertake. You make connections with students. You make connections with their families. You know every day that you're impacting them in positive ways, that you're shaping their future and that you're shaping the future of our world. And it's really important to our society that we value that profession in a way that will draw our best and brightest to it. And I just am hoping that people who are out there listening will still consider education. I believe that, you know, conversations like this are going to help us make the improvements we need to make. And I would love to see as many great people as we can get pursuing teaching as a career. It's just that important.
Jeff Bohl, principal of Lakeview High School in Battle Creek. It's always great talking with you, Jeff. Thank you so much.
Thank you again, Cindy, very much.
Today's Stateside was directed by Allie Billings and engineered by Bob Scon. Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors are Mike Blank, Danny Hensel, Mercedes Mejia, and Lindsay Scullin. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so very much for listening.